I've said a lot recently, and I said in the first service, you know, there are three gifts that God has given the church. And there are three types of messages that Dan and I will be bringing to our congregation. They're defined in Ephesians 4. One is evangelism. Of course, we always want to be evangelistic. However, you know, once you're born again, you don't need to be born again. You're only saved once. Now, it's good to have that reaffirmed periodically. And it's good that we all be skilled in how to share our faith with others. That's why we have Evangelism Explosion. I hope you've either gone through it or you're taking advantage of the course that we're offering right now. Then there's the area of teaching, making disciples. That's the Great Commission. Go into all the world and make disciples. That's a Christ follower. We're supposed to follow Christ in every area of our life, and it should be evident in every area of our life. And then the third thing is shepherding, pastors, taking care of, watching out for your flock. That's what this message is about today, and that's what I've been covering the last couple of weeks. And I must say, and I'm pleased in a way to see it, but I'm also sad to see that over the last 2 years, we've seen an example of shepherding. And these pastors that have recklessly told their congregations just to go out and participate in some nationwide genetic experimentation with mRNA injection that's never been attempted before on human beings, I think that is not doing a very good job of shepherding your flock. I was very disappointed when Robert Jeffress and Franklin Graham both came out and made the asinine statement that if you love your neighbor, you'd go get the shot. That's ridiculous. This thing is, and it's being proven to be true. Everything that's coming out now, we realize just how reckless that was. But that is a position of pastoring or protecting or guiding or shepherding your congregation, which we take very seriously. Obviously, as shepherds of this flock, we want to make sure that we want to at least give everyone that's in the sound of our voice the opportunity to hear the gospel. We can't make the decision for Christ for you, but we certainly want you to be aware of the decision that is laid before you and encourage you to make it. But we also want you to flourish and do well in your jobs. We want you to be comfortable financially. We want you to budget biblically. We want you to be good parents. You know what? It's easy just to ignore your child. But the Bible says if you love your child, you're going to smack them on the behind every now and then whenever they are defiant. You don't punish a child for being a child, but you do punish willful resistance, willful defiance. And that's why we have so much cushion back there. There's no bones back there. I used to have some cushion back there. I don't know what happened to it. Anyway, it vanished over the last 10 years or so. But, you know, I tell you, Mom and Dad made good use of that. I didn't get many spankings, but, boy, I got some good ones. And trust me, they paid off. I learned the lesson. But anyway, we want your families to be strong and healthy. We want you to be able to pay your bills. We want you to be healthy and hopefully have good, full lives. So all of that is our concern. And we want to see you flourish in every area. Well, today, again, is going to be a pastoral message. It's the third of three messages that we have done, and, of course, on this subject of safety within the walls. Today, we're going to focus specifically on judgment and righteous judgment. Well, our text came from the 55th Psalm. And, of course, we know as David sang this song unto God, he said, Jerusalem's walls are patrolled day and night against invaders. But the real danger is evil within the city. Everything is falling apart. Threats and cheating are rampant in the streets. It's not an enemy who taunts me. I could bear that. It's not my foes who so arrogantly insult me. I could have hidden from them. Instead, it is you, my equal, my companion and close friend. What good fellowship we once enjoyed as we walked together to the house of God. Of course, you remember David was in a crisis, and he couldn't help but taking note of the condition of the city. The walls were strong. They hadn't been breached. The watchtowers were all manned. Patrols were on guard around the city. And David noted that there was no threat from the outside. He also noted that the danger lay within the walls. As a matter of fact, when we reflect upon biblical history, we realize that his own son Absalom and his own trusted counselor Ahithophel were leading an insurrection against him. Now from this passage, we have made some applications to our day. The Apostle Peter tells us that Satan goes about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And rest assured, he's after each and every one of us. He wants to destroy you. He wants to destroy your home. He wants to destroy your children. He wants to destroy your reputation. He wants to destroy your marriage. And he certainly wants to destroy your church. And he always uses the same basic strategy of attack. He used it against that first great church in Jerusalem, just months after the resurrection. He used it at Philippi, that first great church in Europe. He used it at Ephesus, the epicenter of paganism, as the Temple of Diana, one of the ancient wonders of the ancient world, sat there in the city of Ephesus. And a great church that was there that combated it and engaged and transformed the culture. And he uses it today against any church that's trying to do something great in God's service, which means he either is already or will certainly be using it against us. The first thing Satan does is try to bully or bluff or intimidate or persecute a church into silence from some external attack. And of course, this works with a lot of churches. Look back at the last 2 years. See how many churches couldn't close their doors fast enough over this magic virus that didn't attack you at Home Depot or Walmart, but would certainly attack you if you sang a hymn or gathered together to pray and preach. And this kind of attack will work on some, but it won't work on a strong church, on a great church. An external attack as such, being in the fire, will only unify or strengthen a great church. Strong churches get stronger and draw together during times of external attacks. So Satan always goes to plan B. He seeks to infiltrate and divide the church from within through pettiness, pride, gossip, or hurt feelings. Well, how do we defend against pettiness, pride, gossip, and hurt feelings? Well, you have to do it intentionally. You have to do it on purpose and with purpose. You have to recognize it when it raises its ugly head, and you have to stamp it out and stop it. In week one, we gave some very simple points that we can apply to ourselves in coming to church as we gather, hopefully at least twice a week here, as a place of respite within these walls, a place where Hebrews says we are to encourage one another, to observe one another, accountability and encouragement so we can provoke unto love and to good works. This needs to be, as I've preached before, this is the huddle in a football game. You know, we had 75 or 80 plays in a typical football game as an offensive football player in the day that I played. The battle raged at the snap of the football until the whistle was blown. Then we'd get back in the huddle. We'd take account of ourselves and each other. Check with each other. How you feeling? You okay? I saw you limping out there. I'll help you on that next block. We'll combination block that next time. We would communicate with each other and be ready for the next play. Then we'd line up and snap the football. That's when the action was on. Ladies and gentlemen, this isn't serving the Lord. This is the huddle. We're coming together to be taught, to be encouraged, to love on one another. When you exit today, that's going out to engage in the service of the Lord. So one of the things we said whenever you come here is, first of all, wear a smile. This is easy to do. And attitude is everything. When you put a smile on your face, you're going to naturally say, I'm in a better mood, even if you got to fake it for a while. And when you come to church smiling, when others see you, they're going to respond in the same. If they see you frowning coming in, they're going to get defensive. They're going to put that wall of protection up. But if they see you smiling and happy coming in the door, you're going to most likely set the stage for a very pleasant conversation and interaction with others. Number two, we said be patient and kind to everyone. You know, 1 Corinthians 13 gives us a list Paul gives of agape. There are 17 attributes listed in 1 Corinthians 13. We're starting off making it easy. Just focus on the first two. Be patient with one another as it's crowded at church. You may have a hard time finding a parking place that's fairly conveniently located. Our parking lot is too small. As others are exiting from the first service and you're coming in the second service, you might have some sort of interaction in the parking lot. Be patient and be kind. By the way, we're supposed to do this with all of our neighbors. That means everybody that we go to church with. That also means your closest neighbor, which is your spouse, who you share a life with. It's amazing how patient and kind we are through the courtship process. Why in the world do we think once you say, I do, you don't have to be patient and kind anymore? You should be far more concerned about somebody you are joined to forever in the eyes of the Lord than somebody that's actually just an acquaintance during the dating process. Third, never, ever, 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 ever gossip. You know, it's amazing. Growing up Baptist, I was warned about the dangers of playing cards. I was warned about dancing. I was warned about alcohol and cigarettes and all those things. And as I've gone through my Bible repeatedly, I know we're supposed to take care of our bodies. However, I can't see specifics that cigarettes is a sin. I see dancing the other direction. However, one thing I do see throughout the Old and New Testament is the subject of gossiping. As a matter of fact, the old rabbinical truth was that gossip actually murdered three people. Gossip murders the person you're gossiping about in the eyes of others. Gossip hurts or damages or kills the person you're talking to because it destroys their opinion of the other person. And then it murders your credibility because people get tired of being around to gossip. So from the Jewish perspective, this was obviously something that was off the books. Then I said, take the initiative and make friends. We all have a tendency of being shy. We're all shy. Believe it or not, he's relatively shy. When he's on stage, he lights up. But if you catch Dan off the stage, he's fairly shy. I am as well. You think that I'm an outgoing person? I've become an outgoing person because I have to. That's actually part of the job that we have to do here. We're going out and engaging the world. When we go to Council for National Policy meetings, we interact with other things. I'm not big on small talk. Quite frankly, a perfect day for me is just to be at home with my wife and kids, play a little golf, grab a steak, and just be in the family. Not terribly outgoing, but we all have a little bit of that in us. But take the initiative when you come to church. Take the initiative when you go out somewhere. You be friendly first. You make the first step to reach out and befriend someone else and break the ice. Then in week two, we examined another great church. We examined the great church that began in Scrooby, England, and wound up in Holland, and then ultimately ventured across the Atlantic and landed in Plymouth, Massachusetts, for some two decades, pastored by the great John Robinson. This painting on the screen up here depicts the embarkation of the Speedwell as the congregation, which numbered between 300 and 400, was dividing permanently at the time. Just a small group from their church, about 75 from their congregation, 75 of these separatists were departing to come to the new world and stick a stake in the ground. The others were planning on coming later. Pastor Robinson never lived long enough to come to the new world. But before they split, he wound up giving them a letter of pastoral instruction. It gave great counsel in several areas, but two we took note of. One was never attempt to intentionally offend a brother or sister in church. And two, be careful not to easily be offended by someone in church. As the Jewish rabbinical tradition stated from 100 years before the birth of Christ, let your thumb be heavy on the scale for your neighbor. In other words, give your neighbor every benefit of the doubt. Assume that he didn't intend to offend you. Assume it was all a misunderstanding. And most of the time you'll find that that's exactly the case. Jesus recited and restated this truth in Luke 6, verses 36 through 38, a passage that I have heard improperly used to teach tithing. That's not what this is talking about. It says this, you be full of mercy, just as your Father also is full of mercy. I couldn't help but stop there in the first service. I hadn't planned to, but I did. And I'm going to stop in this service as well. Just think about the last 24 hours. Think about the last 24 hours. And have you done anything or thought anything to which God could have just killed you over and justly done so? I don't know, maybe not. But I know I rarely go 24 hours in any given day where I'm just not ashamed of some thought that I've had or some reaction that I've had. And I go, oh, God, forgive me. I'm so glad we have a God that is full of mercy. And if our God is merciful towards us, we certainly should be merciful toward those that he died for. Judge not, and you shall not be judged. Condemn not, and you shall not be condemned. In other words, by what standard you measure, it will be measured of you. Forgive, and you shall be forgiven. Now, here's the metaphor. Give, and it shall be given unto you in good measure. Pressed down, shaken together, and running over. Shall men give into your bosom? I'll explain that in a moment. For with the same measure that you meet, withal it shall be measured to you again. So that's the point of this. And the metaphor was as if you went to the market and you went to buy grain in the market. They would stick the scoop or the cup down in there and shake it around a little bit so it settles. Then they'd put some more in and shake it down so it settles. And they'd put some more on top and pat it down a little bit until it was full and overflowing. Then that would be, when you read of the KJV, tossed in the lap, or in this case, in your bosom. Rather than having a plastic Walmart grocery sack, you would take your garment and make a little pouch or papoose up there, almost like a kangaroo would have. That's what's being talked about here. Now, number 7, we're going to make one point today, but we're going to take several applications from that point. Evaluate every situation justly. In the Torah, which we interpret as law, but actually it literally means God's instruction for us, God's guidance for his people, we see the consistency of this idea of justice and righteousness in judgment. Deuteronomy 32:4, we see God's character where it says, he is the rock. His work is perfect. All his ways are justice. A God of truth and without injustice. Righteous and upright is he. Next, we see his command for the family of Israel in Deuteronomy 16, verse 18. Judges and officers shalt thou make in all thy gates, which the Lord thy God giveth thee throughout the tribes, and they shall judge the people with just judgment. Leviticus 19, verse 15. You shall do no unrighteousness in judgment. Thou shalt not respect the person of the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty, but in righteousness shalt thou judge thy neighbor. So, in other words, no favoritism, no bias in justice or in judgment, just justice in your judgment. That's why you see these statues of Lady Justice holding the scales of justice, being blindfolded. Because justice is supposed to be blind. No favoritism towards the rich or no favoritism towards the poor. Just objective, just, righteous judgment. And we know that one day King Jesus will literally rule and reign planet Earth from Jerusalem. And he will rule and reign in righteousness. Isaiah 11 gives us a messianic passage about the kingdom. It says this about the Messiah. The Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him. The Spirit of wisdom and understanding. The Spirit of counsel and power. The Spirit of knowledge. He will judge the impoverished justly. He will decide fairly for the humble of the land. Justice will be the belt around his waist, and faithfulness the sash around his hips. That read from the complete Jewish version of the Bible. But until that day, we as followers of Christ are supposed to shine for him. We must be objective and just in our judgment, whether it be at church or at home in our family affairs or in business. Always seek that which is right and that which is righteous. Ladies and gentlemen, this is critical knowledge. You may be a deacon and have to arbitrate between two with differences within the church body. You may have to counsel a married couple, but more likely, each and every one of us need this personally for ourselves. We need to be honest with ourselves in our own situations. You may be angry with your boss about something. You better judge that justly. You may be angry at your job about something or your coworkers. You better be objective in your judgment. And you might get angry at this church. Might be angry with me or Dan or with somebody else in the church. Well, you better be objective in evaluating the situation and judge righteously. I'm amazed at how many people I have seen over 22 years that have come to my office. And trust me, I have heard everything. I actually had a murder confessed in my office. So when I say I've heard everything, I've heard everything. A lot of things I wish I could cover my ears and go, no, 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 don't say it, don't say it, don't say it. Oh, you said it. Oh, crud. But I've been amazed at how many people I've had come to my office and say, this is the greatest church I've ever seen. Wow, what a blessing. I had one young lady that had gone off into atheism as she was a scientist. She came to this church and came back around, was a committed Christian. She said one day in my office after church, she said, Pastor, if I had had a pastor like you growing up, I would have never gone off into atheism. Well, it's amazing how many people come in there singing our praises, singing the praise of this church, and then 6 months later or 1 year later or 2 years later, I look around and go, what happened to so-and-so? And all that's left is that little poof of dust is like the roadrunner when he leaves the room. Be objective in evaluating any differences that you yourself may be involved in. I've shared over the last couple of weeks a little bit about one of my mentors, my Bible teacher that I had a lot of training under, Dr. Mike Hayes. Dr. Hayes was hilarious. He was a little guy. He was as tall as he was round, literally about 5.5 feet tall and about 5.5 feet around. Not many 5 feet, 5 foot, 6 inch, 320-pound preachers in the world. And he would get out there and he would stand on the front pew to make sure and get your attention. Pay attention. Walk up and down the aisles just in case, or worse, weren't paying attention. Every now and then I would see him walk over the pews. I'd go, oh, please don't fall, Brother Mike. Please don't fall, Brother. But he was a great, wise Bible counselor. And he taught me that counseling was one of the most important jobs of the pastor shepherd for his congregation. Sadly, most pastor shepherds don't counsel at all anymore. But this is a critical ministry for the flock. But he was such a blessing to me. And through my development, he is being a blessing to you. Because I'm going to bring out a couple of very obvious points in today's message. This is not exhaustive. This just scratches the surface. But please try to wrap your hands around these few truths that we're going to share this morning. Truth number one. Recognize that justice is not naturally in your Adamic nature. So you must intentionally bring your Adamic nature into obedience. Every one of us are descendants of Adam. Pastor Dan, we all are descendants of Adam, and we have to be careful about this. Jeremiah 17:9 says this, the heart is full of deceit above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? That word deceitful is translated in other passages in the Old Testament as polluted and as crooked. The heart is crooked above all things. The heart is polluted above all things and desperately wicked. That means it's incurable. That means that your heart can't be fixed. That's why Jesus offers to give us a new one, according to Jeremiah 31, according to Ezekiel 36. That's what the new birth was all about that Jesus talked about with Nicodemus in John 3. The complete Jewish Bible translates this passage like this. The heart is more deceitful than anything else and mortally sick. Who can fathom it? I, Adonai, search the heart. I test inner motivations in order to give to everyone what his actions and conduct deserve. Just recognize that we all have been born with, God has given us a survival instinct. That's why when you're fixing to cross the street and you start to step out and a car comes by and you step back, your heart skips a beat and starts beating faster because your body instinctively desires to survive. That's why you pull your hand away from a hot stove because your body instinctively is designed to defend itself and designed to survive. Well, you naturally will see things from your own point of view. Your point of view naturally and on its own will be biased to some degree. Now, as a mature Christian, hopefully you can minimize that bias to where maybe it only affects your decision-making by 1% or 2% or 5%. Immature Christians will be childish, and that bias might be 50% or 75% of their decision-making. But don't fool yourself. You are a human being. You will see things from your point of view. And Paul said on this very issue, while dealing with and chastising with the immature, childish church in Corinth, they were proud. They each thought that he or she was more important than others. They were very cliquish, clinging to different apostles as if the apostle that they followed was more impressive or more important than other apostles. Yet some say, oh, I'm of the clique of Apollos, or I'm of the clique of Paul, or I'm of the clique of Peter. And the apostle Paul rebuked all that. Can you imagine being in our congregation and having part of the congregation say, oh, I follow Pastor Dan. Oh, I follow Pastor Paul. Hopefully we're all just following the Lord. And that's what Paul's saying. He says, let a man so account of us. In other words, we're all Apollos, me, Peter, just ministers of Christ and stewards of the mystery of God. Moreover, as stewards, it's required of us that we be found faithful. But with me, it's a very small thing that I should be judged of you. In other words, Paul says, I really don't give a rip about what your opinion about me is. Or of man's judgment in general. Yea, I don't even trust myself. I don't even trust my own opinion about my own work. For I know nothing by myself. Here's what he's saying. I have a clear conscience, yet I am not hereby justified. Just because my conscience is clear doesn't mean that I'm right. I don't trust myself or my own opinion because I recognize that I'm biased, is what Paul's saying. But he that judges me is the Lord. All that matters is what the Lord thinks. Therefore, judge nothing before the time. That's what I just read in Jeremiah 17, 10 a moment ago. Until the Lord come, who will bring to light the hidden things of darkness and will make manifest the counsels of the heart, and then every man shall have praise of God. In other words, God, the Lord, when the Lord judges, it won't just be on what we do, but the Lord will be able to honestly discern the thoughts and intents of our heart that motivated while we're doing things. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you will naturally see things from your own point of view. Naturally, on its own, your point of view will be biased. So be honest with yourself. You must recognize this and always be aware of it. Otherwise, you will never be objective in your judgment. Recognize that justice is just not naturally in your Adamic nature, so you must intentionally bring your Adamic nature into submission and obedience. Point B, listen to everything, but believe nothing. Most people aren't wanting counsel. Most people come to you looking for someone to agree with them and to take their side of an argument. In fact, Solomon said in Proverbs 18, the first to state his case seems right until the other person comes to give his side of the story. So you listen to all accounts and recognize that truth lies somewhere in between. If there was an automobile accident, an officer would come and first talk to both drivers, discerning what they had to say. Then he would interview the bystanders. Everyone would tell what they saw from their perspective. Now, the drivers certainly have a vested interest to espouse their sides of the story in order to vindicate themselves, but the bystanders usually don't have any interest. But an officer will take it all into account, everybody's version of what they saw, everybody's perspective, everybody's position, and then recognize that truth always lies somewhere in the middle. If there's a husband and a wife, they're in a fight, it could be 90-10 her way versus his, or 90-10 his way versus hers. It could be 80-20. It could be 50-50. But the judge or the counselor must be objective. The counselor must examine the actual evidence for more than opinions. In fact, if you've ever seen a law show, I don't watch anything anymore. Nothing's worth law. This was the old, what was it? Good grief. Was it Perry Mason? I think it's what it was. But in a courtroom, the defense attorney may say, objection, Your Honor, conjecture. In other words, objection, Your Honor, that's merely an opinion that's being stated. And the judge would say, sustained. Why? Because facts matter. Opinions, not so much. Jeremiah 17:9 said that if you let your imagination run wild, you can create a reality that doesn't exist. So when you're counseling someone, listen for buzzwords versus actual statements of fact. A buzzword is something like, well, I think, or I feel. Recognize that this is feeling. That's feeling. What you feel and what you think doesn't matter if you are in a court of law. That's one of the reasons that Jesus' judgment will be so amazing. Jesus can actually discern the thoughts of your heart. We can't. That's why I hate such things as they're going down the road of hate crimes. You know what? If person A murders person B, he should be tried and found guilty or innocent based upon the actual fact of committing murder. You know, if someone kills me, I don't really care whether they were just crazy or whether they hated me. Either way, I'm dead. So it's not the thought that matters, it's the action by which we are always judged. So as you consider any statement or disagreement, it's fine to listen to what someone is feeling. It's fine to listen to their opinion. However, what matters the most are the facts. If this was a courtroom, would that testimony or that statement stand? And again, let me repeat, if you think people are coming for an honest, objective opinion about their situation, or if you think people are coming for counsel, most of the time you would be wrong. Usually people are looking for someone to affirm the decision that they've already made or to agree with their side of the story. They want to convince you that they are right. Now, make sure you aren't guilty of this. Point C, given enough time, any man can justify just about any behavior. Let me give you one illustration from Scripture. David is called a man after God's own heart. And we know so many wonderful attributes of David's faith and faithfulness. However, one very sad time is recorded in 2 Samuel 11. David was at a pinnacle as far as his rule. He was the most dominant military in that part of the world. He was wealthy. Everything was good. And consequently, that's when we are most vulnerable. Usually when times are going well, those are the days we tell the Lord He can take the day off. When someone's sick, or you're in need of a job, or you might lose your job, then you're on your face begging God for intervention. Usually it's the times of ease or prosperity that we are most vulnerable to attack, and David was. Scripture says it was a time when kings go to war, but David wasn't at war. David sent General Joab and his military off to fight Ammon. David stayed home to enjoy the comfort of life as a king. And understand that David wasn't initially doing anything wrong. David's home was on the upper part of the city. I should have put a slide in here. Mount Moriah was actually a very thin peninsula. Jerusalem today covers Mount Moriah, Mount Zion, and several other mounts in the area. Actually crosses the Tropian Valley and other areas. But initially, the city of David was a very thin walled city. And the king lived all the way at the upper end of the city. There was a reason why the upper city was more valuable than the lower city. In their day, they didn't have the sanitation system that we have today, where you just flush the toilet. So garbage and rubbish went from uphill, downhill. So the king's house, there was nobody uphill from David, so he didn't have to deal with any of it. The lower you went in the city, the less value of the property, and you can understand why. But also they lived in a day that there was no air conditioning. And David was out on the roof of his palace on the upper part of the city. So literally he could look down, had a vantage point to see everything in the city and around the city. course, with no air conditioning, the most comfortable spot in the cool of the day would be on the roof of your home or the patio. And generally, that was considered a private space because nobody from the street level could see you. So David was out on the roof of his place, and one of his mighty men of valor, the scripture says, Uriah the Hittite, lived close by. This was like David's most trusted personal guards. They were leaders of his military. Uriah was a faithful servant of King David. And Uriah was off to war with General Joab. Well, his wife decided to take a bath. Bathsheba wasn't doing anything wrong. Again, the patio was the upstairs, the roof of your home. That's where you would go in the cool of the day. She was taking a bath. King David happened to be taking a stroll, peeked over the edge of his house. You know what? It's not a sin to observe that something's beautiful. If he had observed something, oh my goodness, she's gorgeous. Oh, look away. It's not my wife. He wouldn't have done anything wrong. Where David went wrong is he saw how beautiful she was and then fixed his eyes on her and began lusting after her and then sent for her. Those around said, isn't this Uriah's wife? What's he doing? And of course, we know what happened. King David had an affair with Bathsheba, and Bathsheba wound up becoming pregnant. So David sought to cover his sin. He sent to have Uriah come home on leave. Uriah gave him a report as to what was going on at the battle. And then David said, good job, Uriah. Why don't you go home for a couple of days and enjoy spending time with your wife, and then you can go back to the front. Well, Uriah was such an honorable man. He said, I cannot do that. I've got my brothers in arms. They are in the field. They're sleeping in tents. They're sleeping under the stars. Their lives are in danger every day. They're fighting for you, King. How can I go home and enjoy the pleasures of marriage when my countrymen are off in battle? And Uriah stayed the night at the front door of David's palace. So David said, okay, here's what we'll do. We'll have a party in Uriah's honor. We'll get him intoxicated. Then he'll use poor judgment and go home and sleep with his wife. Well, Uriah, drunk, was a better man than David was sober at that point in time. And even at that condition, Uriah would not go home with his wife. Again, slept in the door of the king's palace because he had that kind of honor. So what David did when he recognized the situation is he sought to cover his tracks. He wrote a letter to General Joab, which said this, put Uriah in the hottest part of the battle where valiant men go to die. And then I want you to pull back our troops and leave him there alone. Uriah took that sealed order, his own death sentence, faithfully took it back to Joab and gave it to him. And that's exactly what happened. Uriah was killed. You realize that David had a clean conscience? David had justified everything that he had done, including committing adultery with another man's wife and having that man killed. David didn't pull the trigger, but he might as well have. He gave the orders that had him killed. He had justified it in his own mind, and he was at peace. As a matter of fact, as you read the passage of Scripture, we don't know. It could have been a full 9 months or 12 months. Either the baby was just about to be born or was already born because David had taken Bathsheba as his own wife after Uriah had been found dead. And David was at peace when that Baptist preacher, Nathan, came to pay him a visit. Don't you hate it when the preacher comes over? I know my wife hates it when the preacher comes home. I think yours does too, she's told me. But Nathan came in, and get this, David had justified everything that he had done subjectively because it was about him. There's bias there, even the man after God's own heart. So Nathan wisely drew out the objectivity in David. Since David was the king, he was the ultimate judge for the kingdom. And Nathan said, King David, I have a problem. I need your input on this. There was a rich man that had flocks of sheep. And then he had a neighbor that just had one little female sheep. And that little female sheep was just like a pet. He'd let the sheep come in the house. It fed it from the table. And that was just the most precious thing in that man's life. Well, you know, that rich man had a guest come to pay him a visit. And rather than taking from his own flock, he went next door and took that man's one little beloved sheep, and he butchered that sheep and ate it for dinner and served it to his guest. David, what should we do, King? And David judged righteously. Because David was pulled out of the situation personally and was objective. And he actually judged according to the law. When you stole something, you didn't go to prison. If you stole something, you paid for it four times over. You worked it off and learned your lesson. David said, that man should pay for it fourfold. And on top of that, he ought to be put to death. Nathan, about that time, did one of these things and said, Nathan, King, you are that man. And David was grieved in his spirit and genuinely repentant. When he recognized what he was done, he was so ashamed of himself and wanted to make it right. Of course, that baby did die, just as David had said. God didn't kill David. God took that baby from him. And then David wound up losing four more sons along the way. One of them was Absalom. But the point is this. If even a man after God's own heart could judge with bias on a personal situation that he was involved in, given enough time, could justify just about anything. And by the way, if it can happen to King David, don't be so proud to think that it couldn't happen to you. Oh, my wife has just become frigid. Where she's not, it's not things like, not like they used to be. Therefore, she drove me into the arms of another woman. No, she didn't. First of all, you need counseling early on. Ladies, don't become frigid. Bible talks about that. But there's still not an excuse. But the point is this. We can, if left alone, justify just about anything. If it can happen to King David, it can happen to us. So be careful. Don't judge subjectively. Judge objectively. Then the final point, which is basically a summary of what we've already talked about. Be objective in your judgment, especially if you're trying to determine a situation in which you yourself are involved. Don't trust yourself. David couldn't. Nathan had to draw out his objectivity by having him judge a hypothetical case. Paul wouldn't. The Apostle Paul said, I have a clear conscience, but I don't trust my own judgment because I recognize that I could be biased about myself. And we shouldn't. Jeremiah states clearly that the heart is deceitful. The heart is crooked. Who can trust it? So be objective. Don't trust yourself. Passionately seek righteousness. Passionately pursue that which is just. Folks, I'm not terribly old, but I feel it. My body is beat up. I have got high miles on this car. But I've had a lot of years of experience as a pastor. And as a young man, I think all of us, as young Christians, we diligently search for proof texts to make sure if we get in a debate or a conversation with somebody from some other denomination that we can prove that our side is right. Hey, what we believe as Baptists, this is right, and here's the verse. You know, I've gotten to the point where I don't go to proof texts anymore. I'm not trying to win a debate anymore. I'm not trying to win an argument anymore. I want to make sure that I'm right. And every time I study the Bible, I go through it and I want to be consistent. I want to make sure that as I'm studying it with fresh eyes, am I right on what I conclude that this says? Had a meeting several years ago when we were very involved in the Islam issue. I met the local head of the Council of American Islamic Relations for coffee down in the northern part of the city over near Pennsylvania. And the Kilpatrick Turnpike. We met for coffee and we sat down and I immediately addressed the elephant in the room. I said, we both have very strong beliefs, but what you believe and what I believe are polar opposites. They're extremely different. I said, I'm not trying to win any debate. I want to make sure that I'm right. And you, if you're concerned about your eternity, should seek the same. So folks, recognize that we are flawed. We are humans. As descendants of Adam, we are going to carry some degree of bias. Make sure that you're aware of it. And make sure that you're objective in all judgment, whether you're asked to counsel and help another couple that you're friends with, or whether you're involved in a situation at work or a disagreement with somebody in your Sunday school class. Make sure that you judge righteous judgment. Judge objectively. Recognize that you can give yourself leeway. You, if given enough time, you can justify anything that you want to do. And make sure that your goal is always that which is right. Not trying to win the argument. I want to make sure that I'm right. I want to make sure that I glorify God. And God wants righteous judgment in all things. And we should too.